This Week in Retronauts, we're getting roided up. Everyone, and welcome to yet another Retronauts East episode.
I didn't think you noticed my muscles.
You've been juicing, man.
Yeah.
I'm Jeremy Parrish, and as usual for a Metroid dun-dun-dun focused episode, it's also
Ben Jedwards
and
Chris Sims.
And we're here, going to talk about the stuff that we've been talking about, but we're going to talk about a different part of the stuff that we've been talking about. So we haven't talked about
the
it
third
yet.
Part of the stuff.
Yes, that's correct. So we have in the previous Metroidvania episodes discussed the prehistory of Metroidvania and also Metroidvania games that appeared on the NES, which was kind of like the fertile crescent of Metroidvania game design. So now we're going to be talking about games from the 80s and 90s that weren't on NES. And as we'll find, there actually weren't that many of them. I don't know what it was specifically about the NES that just made people say, I want to design games that are like Mario, but maze-like. That ethos didn't really exist, on the competing platforms. And then when, the technology transferred over to Super NES, that all but disappeared. There's like three Super NES Metroidvania games. It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's not even a Super NES like Castlevania game as a Metroidvania.
Yeah, one of the two Super NES Castlevania games is a more linear version of a sort of exploratory PC Engine game.
Yeah.
They like took out all the extra stuff.
Everything that's good, let's take it out and bring it to America. That's what they said, right?
That was the ethos there, yes.
Okay. So we're referring to Dracula X. Mm-hmm. Rondo of Blood.
That's not Rondo of Blood in America. Okay. It's just Dracula X.
Yeah, well, we're referring to the...
You can also call it Vampire's Kiss if you want.
Okay. We're referring to both games.
Okay.
Dracula X being the interpretation of Rondo of Blood.
But it's good to recognize them as different games because they are.
Yeah, they're definitely different games. Okay.
But they are not Metroidvania games, either one of them, although Rondo of Blood definitely comes close. However, it doesn't quite qualify for the purposes of this discussion. Maybe next episode when we talk about Symphony of the Night. In our part four Metroidvania episode, we can talk about Rondo.
With some of the stuff you've got on this list for this episode, you might as well talk about Rondo of Blood. Because they're
like I said, we can talk about it next time
in
the context of Symphony of the Night.
Okay.
I've got this all mapped out. Don't worry.
We're mapping.
Okay. We're okay. Yep.
It's that mapping thing.
Unlike Metroidvania, Metroid 2, this podcast comes with a map.
That joke yet because we haven't published that episode.
Give
yet.
It a week. Yeah. It'll be mildly amusing.
This is like Back to the Future. I'm getting confused.
So which one of us is the stand-in for Donald Trump? All right. So with that terrible note, let's let's begin this discussion. Actually, maybe we should begin this discussion by contemplating why
is a Metroidvania?
No. Why did the Metroidvania genre appear so sparsely outside of the NES? What's up with that?
I have to imagine that at least part of it is because they're hard to make, right? Like they require, if they're going to be good, they require a level of thoughtfulness, which you see in Metroid, which you see in Metroid 2. But
a ton of NES Metroidvania games like Blaster Master, they're really great. There was no lack of quality there.
I can give you a technical answer that you won't like, which is none of these games are Metroidvanias until Castlevania Symphony of the Night came out.
Congratulations, you're technically correct, which is the worst kind of correct.
That's why there are so few for other platforms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some of these where you're reaching quite a bit, I think, toward Metroidvania. But, you know, there are some that are like, that were earlier we've talked about.
I forgot how anal retentive you are about this imaginary word. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, but as we discussed, a word has to have a common meaning among people or else it's pointless to talk about.
The common meaning is exploratory platformer. So, well, all good.
You mentioned platformers, and I think that's part of it too, because if you look at the NES era and then the post-NES era, there are a couple of really dominant genres. There's the Mario-style platformer, obviously, that continues into the Super NES. And there's, once the Super NES arrives, there's the fighting game. And then there's the side-scrolling beat-em-up, which would be every licensed game. Like, every movie would have an accompanying side-scrolling beat-em-up, like we talked about with the Batman episode. So
yeah,
you get those games that I think are generally, you know, not to knock them terribly, because I love Final Fight, but they don't require as much thoughtfulness. You only have
Most of those games required very little thoughtfulness in terms of design. It's just like, let's just put the same three dudes out here over and over again.
2P.
Or not 2P. Yeah, we get there.
I hear you.
High five.
And what was the other guy's name? 2P and what?
Jay.
Jay, that's right.
It was 2P and Jay.
That's my favorite kind of sandwich.
It's peanut butter, pickles, and jelly.
Sorry.
Peanut butter.
2P and J. It says two pickles and
okay.
Jelly.
Wow, I only had like a sip of this. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, this is already a wild one.
So,
I'm over here with water ready to talk about Metroidvanias.
Yeah, you fool. I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, as I've been preparing these extensive notes for this episode, like, what did happen? And, you know, sort of thinking back on it, the most vibrant time for the style of game was like 1987, 88, barely into 89. Well, what happened around then? Well, at the end of 1988, Super Mario Brothers 3 came out in Japan. And I think
that changed the focus.
It was a linear platformer that was just as full of content and ideas and surprises and things to find as any of these exploratory platformers. And I think it kind of made people step back and say, you know, we don't necessarily have to create these convoluted, exploratory, interlocking worlds where it's easy to get lost and people give up and get frustrated. We can create the same sort of wealth of content, this richness of design, in a game that is a lot more straightforward and a lot more accessible. And I think if you look after Super Mario Brothers 3 launches in Japan, which of course is where most good NES games were designed, you see people step back away from the sort of freeform, open-ended, continuous world platform design in favor of games that just kind of take more of a Mario approach. I think also Mario 3 kind of marks an important technological step for the system, because, you know, platformers started with things like Pitfall and Jet Set Willy, where you had a single screen connected to a single screen connected to it. Like, it was, you know, you'd flip from one screen to the next. There was no scrolling. Super Mario Brothers, Metroid, and so forth, you got to scrolling, but it was just on one axis. Super Mario Brothers 3 was, as far as I can remember, the first game to have two-axis scrolling on NES. Like, it was a technological step forward, you know, having the ability to go left and right and up and down and within the same space.
You know why they were the first? Is because Nintendo developed the mapper.
The MMC mapper. Yeah, it was a technological improvement for the system. But it also, you know, is one of those cases where technology brings game design change. So you were limited to just moving along, you know, left or right or up and down. You could do all of it. You see that in Mario 3 stages. Like, the very first stage, there's the ground path. But if you get the leaf, you can run and jump, and there's this entire path up in the sky with bonuses and stuff.
And you can backtrack, too, in the same level.
Yeah. All of a sudden, you have a game that is Mario, you know, left or right, get to the goal. But it has all these other things in it, too. And I think that freedom to sort of break up these spaces and make things, you know, digestible, to give people one space at a time to deal with and reward them for exploring within those spaces, I think that really changed up, you know, it sort of gave people the freedom, designers the freedom to create richer experiences without necessarily putting that sort of expectation of you are on an adventure, you're going to finish it from start to finish, or play it from start to finish, you're going to hit your head against Deborah Cliff, you're gonna figure out all these obscure mysteries, and that's the only way you're going to succeed. And so games could be more approachable while still being substantial.
I like this theory, but I think you're thinking a little bit too deeply about it, which is that I don't think the developers were like, oh, we can unlock all these experiences. They're like, we can unlock all this money. That Super Mario Bros. 3 sold like 20 million copies, I want to get into that. So they copycat.
Sure, of course there's financial incentive there, but that's assuming that game developers create games just because they want to be rich, which
they
is
do.
Clearly not the
I
case.
I mean, this is a capitalist system.
It is, but people don't get into making games just because they want to be rich.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Because they, you know, they want to work 100 hours a week
and
maybe get some royalties if their game succeeds. There's a creative impulse here.
The publisher does it because they want to get rich.
Like, I mean, if you look at these games where everything is, you know, becoming, you know, in the 1986, 87, 88, where games are taking on these more expansive designs, it's not because they're like, oh, yes, by you know, adding RPG elements to our video game, we're going to become wealthy. It's, you know.
But what about Zelda 2? I feel like Zelda 2 is what sparked a lot of those.
A lot of them came out before
action
that.
RPGs on the NES.
A lot of them were in development before that. Or
I think
we've talked about this before. But what year was Zelda 2? Was it 87?
It was the beginning of 87.
Okay, and what about Castlevania 2?
Beginning of 87.
Okay.
Well, I think Jeremy
Goonies 2 was beginning of 87. Rygar was beginning of 87. Wingamadola was late 86.
Yeah, so they're all in the same. They're expanding. We've talked about them expanding on Super Mario Brothers, the platforming, adding another dimension to platforming.
I don't know. You're
right?
Just like putting aside the creative impulse, which is a really weird thing to do. Obviously, there's money in there, but that's on the publisher side. On the developer side, it's usually like, we want to make the best game we can. What is the best kind of game we can make? And I think the technology that Super Mario and the design that Super Mario Brothers 3 introduced was a route to, you know, creating great game experiences that weren't quite so taxing, quite so laborious and demanding on the end user. And that's kind of your ideal, is like something that someone can just slide into and play easily and have a great, satisfying experience without necessarily having to, you know, spend time and write down passwords and draw a map and that sort of thing.
You're making me want to play Super Mario Bros. 3 again.
It's a
very good game.
I know.
I think you're onto something, Jeremy, because I think what you see, Castlevania 2 is bad.
What?
God bless it, it tries.
What?
But I think what you see is it's trying
to... It does a lot of bad things, let's say that.
It's trying to put together pieces that even the pieces haven't been refined at that point. But what you see, like, post-Super Mario Bros. 3... is that you see the pieces that we would later come to associate with the Metroidvania genre being refined in other spaces. You see, like, Mario 3, branching pathways, secret areas, like entire secret levels that you could play that game and never see.
Yeah, you on the world map, you can create shortcuts.
Yeah.
Like, people just started talking about a shortcut on one of the maps where you can, like, break a rock and get to the mushroom house or something.
Yeah.
Like, no one knew about that until just now, 2017, 29 years after this game came out.
I knew about the breaking the rock on the path. Is that a new one they found out?
I think so, yeah.
It is in the World 7, right?
Something like that. I can't remember.
There's one where you just break the rock and you go to a whole nother screen.
That's in World 2.
In one of those.
Yeah, it's a different one. It's like something that doesn't seem like you'd be able to do it, but you can.
Oh, cool. Well, I love that.
But then you also see like RPGs getting refined. So you see like inventory systems and picking up different weapons and changing your characters through that way branch off into its own genre. Like what you see, I think, is the proliferation of multiple genres that would later get recombined. Because, like you said, things start off with Pitfall, but you know, Final Fantasy is pretty early, but that's also getting refined throughout, you know, five or six games by the time we get to the end of the Super NES lifespan. So what you see is it all breaking out and being refined so that it can be recombined into what we know.
Yeah, and I would say the other, you know, the other part of the coin, the Super Mario Bros. 3 coin, is the action RPG genre, the top-down Zelda-style experience. The ideas that you see in these Metroidvania games, platformers, they started to show up a lot more frequently, especially on Super NES, in the top-down action game.
Yeah, the Link to the Past style.
Yeah. But even before that came out, you had stuff like Lagoon, you had games like Soul Blazer. Like, there's an entire trilogy by Quintet. Soul Blazer, Illusion of Gaia, Terra Enigma. Like, that right there, that's about as many of these top-down action games as you saw on NES. Plus, there was Secret of Mana. Plus, I mentioned Lagoon. There was, like, Young Merlin, if you want to include that. There were several other games that all linked to the past. They all kind of take this approach.
They're flattened Metroidvanias.
It's top-down Metroidvanias. It's like they, you know, for a while there was this mindset that, like, everything has to be a platformer. And then now platformers kind of went off into the more of the action style. What if we go back and look at Zelda and say there's some merit there? And, you know, I think Nintendo creating A Link to the Past in the style of the original Zelda definitely emboldened people. It made them say, ah, yes, that is the right choice.
And they said, hey, we can make money on that.
But people were already going in that direction. You know, you had Final Fantasy Adventure and before Zelda 2 came out. That was on Game Boy. But then the sequel to that, Secret of Mana, was on Super NES. So
yeah, I love those games.
Yeah, so all those games are great. Yeah,
I was just playing the Minish Cap again recently for the first time in 10 or 12 years, and man, that is a wonderful game. And I was thinking, man, this is just like a Metroidvania, but you can't jump. It's just top down. There's
pretty much
items you unlock and you power up and etc.
Yeah, and anyway. So I think what you really saw happening in this period that we're talking about is this is all sort of preamble to the actual games, is that for the most part, these genres, like Chris said, were starting to sort of go off in different directions and explore different concepts. And, you know, you would see those recombined with Symphony of the Night and some later games, Dark Souls, if you must. That's like the Heianchio alien of everyone else.
Oh, no.
Dark Souls.
I did play it one time, Dark Souls. Yeah.
Chris, have you played Dark Souls?
Can't get into it.
I have not played Dark Souls.
We're like the only, we're the isolated biosphere people, biodome, whatever.
It's because we like a certain kind of game that's kind and tender to us.
Okay. I like to be hugged by my video games.
Exactly. I mean, I love Animal Crossing. What's the Venn diagram, Animal Crossing and Dark Souls?
You'd be surprised.
Is there an overlap?
There is an overlap. Okay. People need their come down after Dark Souls. They're like, I need my animal friends. Chaser. Anyway, Tom Nook is way more evil than anything in Dark Souls.
I understand that Dark Souls is kind of like the lower levels of the mines in Stardew Valley. Is that right?
I haven't played the lower levels of the mines.
I have.
Is that where they delve too deep and too greedily?
Yes, exactly.
You guys are too clever for your own good. I need to just stop this podcast right now.
Anything else to say about this, like this theory that I'm putting forward? Anyone care to refute it?
I think you're right because I think you do see games take their cue from whatever the dominant game is at the time. And in the 80s, it was Super Mario Brothers. Like, Super Mario Brothers redefined video games and defined them for the console market. Like,
except Super Mario Brothers 2, which nobody copied.
But it's still like,
it's not true. Have you played Bible Adventures?
Yeah, Bible Adventures. That's the only one. Yeah, I have. I just did a slideshow on religious video games, by the way.
Then why are you making this reference? You should know better.
That's the only one, though. There's none others where you can pick up and toss animals.
And so that's where you see, like, whatever they do in those games becomes what people do. Like, you even see, like, branching pathways in the later Mega Man games, which are, like, pure, like, action platformers.
Yeah, Mega Man 6 really kind of goes all in on that.
Yeah.
It doesn't do it well, but...
No, it does not.
It's there. Like, nice job, Capcom.
Yeah.
Golf clap.
Okay. So, with that being said, why don't we venture into the world of Metroidvania? Let's backtrack.
Yeah. Backtrack to the year 1986. Okay.
So, we've talked, like I said, about NES games, but there were other games in the style happening, you know, kind of flirting with the ideas that we saw in Metroid and Castlevania 2 and so forth. They didn't necessarily go all in, as Benj will remind us repeatedly.
Yes.
But the spirit was there. The sort of desire was there.
Yeah, burning desire.
The burning desire. So speaking of burning desire, actually, there's no...
there's nothing related to that.
I think the first game that merits mention is the Sega Master System's first foray into this, which was Zillion, which is a pretty strange game because it's based on an anime that is a tie-in to a toy. It was a, like a laser tag gun that was sold in Japan. And there was an anime spinoff, and this game is based on the anime.
Guess what? Isn't the light gun for the Sega Master System the same shape?
The light phaser is the Zillion gun.
Yeah, and Zillion, which is cool. And the toy and the whatever, the anime.
Yep.
Anime.
So we never actually got the Zillion toy line here, but we did get the gun in the form of the light phaser.
Yeah. Zillion, I have a neat story.
But the light phaser does not actually work in Zillion or in the sequel, the Triforce.
You can hold it in one hand while you're playing.
I guess if you want to lose.
Okay. Yeah, I got into the Sega Master System about sometime in the early 90s when I was started collecting old games, and I was pleasantly surprised by Zillion when I first played it because I was like, wow, this has way more depth than I ever thought in a game like this. I mean, because it's an action platformer where you
it's a 1986 action platformer on Sega Master System, which is not like where you go for depth. It's just a little too early and kind of in the wrong space. That wasn't really Sega's forte.
Yeah, exactly. So, but you can power up your guy. I don't know if you wrote in the notes, but you can get better at jumping and have more stamina and have a more powerful gun.
I never survived long enough to find that
out. I don't remember if it persists after you die, though. I don't remember that.
So the death feature is interesting. It's something you would see in other games further down the road, but you have three characters, and each time you die, like, your character's out of the action, and the next character in line takes over. So you have three lives, but each character is a little different, right?
Yeah. I think so. It's actually been a long time.
To remember,
I almost brought the cartridge, but I was like, why should I just show you the cartridge when I can't
play? Yeah, that's not going
to
give me any important clues to
I didn't have the box for it, but... it has this code system where in every stage you shoot these weird trash can looking receptacles to get codes.
Right. So I think it's probably worth mentioning that this game, you know, it's pretty much contemporaneous with the original Metroid. And maybe not surprisingly, it's somewhat simpler than the original Metroid because Metroid was really designed to be to show off the Famicom Disk System hardware, which was an expansion on the NES. Whereas this game, you know, was just kind of like base cartridge level. And so it wasn't really, it was a licensed tie-in as opposed to like a proof of concept for a new platform.
Yeah.
So I think understandably it's not as sophisticated. But instead of doing the scrolling thing, it's more of the classic PC like flip screen thing where you go from one screen to the next.
Time.
And it really draws its cues most heavily, I think, from Impossible Mission. By Epix, right? Wasn't that an Epix game?
I think so.
Whereas you're going through like one screen at a time, you're finding passwords, you're using keys to advance, you're fighting, you know, against passive traps and against enemies while doing so. Like the two games have a lot in common.
Yeah, I didn't notice that until I watched that video you sent me earlier because I would never really played Impossible Mission back in the day.
I felt like the connection was there, and then the video they're referring to is one by Retronauts contributor Kim Justice that she put together a few years ago.
Yeah. And it was a good video, and it does a lays out a convincing argument.
Yeah, she makes that connection and really reinforces it, and I'm glad I wasn't hallucinating because I've never really played Impossible Mission.
Yeah, and I feel like it was a European favorite,
which is why she is, you know, she's UK based, so of course she's all up on her knowledge about that.
And the ZX.
Yes. But I mean, that style of game, you know, I've referred to Jet Set Willy and a few other games along those lines. Like, that style of game was very big on that computer platform. So Impossible Mission was kind of in that same space. And you have Zillion that's kind of drawing on that. Kind of like the Japanese MSX version of Castlevania. It was like single screen, sort of infinitely scrolling loops where it's like... You're exploring, but it's kind of in a limited, finite space. And then once you complete that space, you move on to the next.
Yeah, like a single challenge at a time.
Right.
So you are getting the codes and then unlocking a terminal that lets you go on to the next screen or something like that. Chris, do you know anything about Zillion?
I do not.
Well, you should. Because it's mediocre. But it's really cool for a Sega Master System game.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah, you mentioned in the notes that Opa Opa is like your power. Opa, but you also have to fight Opa Opa. It's kind of weird.
Isn't that a monster from a different game or something?
I mean, Opa Opa is the main character of Fantasy Zone.
Okay, that's what I was talking about.
Yeah.
that ship. That
but they're like, they fly at you and attack you in this living cockpit. But they're also helpful. It's weird.
Yeah.
It's like friend and foe all in one.
I honestly just read that in a instruction manual. Okay. I haven't plugged in Zillion and played it in about 12, 15 years or something. It's been a long time.
So the thing that makes Zillion difficult to play and to map is the fact that the layouts, I think, are consistent from game to game, but the actual codes that you get are changed every time. And they're not just simple codes. They're all these like weird ciphers. So you have to like, in Kim's video, she talked about like mnemonics. Coming up with your mnemonics, like butt and boobs and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they do kind of look like that.
Binoculars. So, I called it binoculars. Yeah,
binoculars. That works too.
Her mind was in the gutter.
as she usually is, if you've read any of her work or watched her videos. So that kind of creates an added level of difficulty because you have this like weird character scheme, and every time you play, it's a different code. It's all randomized.
Wow.
But I mean, I guess that is replay value. Yeah. And otherwise, the game would be kind of simplistic.
And you can't just put out one walkthrough that everyone can follow.
Right. So I had a friend who owned this game back in the day, and I liked the idea of it, but I was always really terrible at it. So I never really, I don't know Zillion as well as I should, but I think it's a pretty cool game and definitely kind of like flirts with the Metroidvania thing, even if it doesn't go all the way in.
Yeah. It's
not a full date. It's just a flirtation.
Yeah. If your upgrades persist after death, I would say it's there. It's sort of a proto Metroidvania.
Right. If your power ups persist after death, the way they don't in Super Mario World,
I would. You're just asking for trouble.
Yeah.
Chris is, he's charging up. He's about to charge.
Go on, Chris.
There are single use items in Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
We're talking about Super Mario World.
Not the fairy candle. Not the cube of Zoe.
I want to digress here for a second, which is I think I realized something that makes for me a true Metroidvania is if you can grind by killing enemies anywhere and get more powerful to go on and be more powerful. So,
but you can't do that in Super Metroid.
You can't do that in Super Metroid.
Super Metroid is not a Metroidvania. It's a Super Metroid.
But you can't do that in any Metroid game, can you?
No, but that's why it's a Metroidvania. It's got to have the Vania in it. It's a Castlevania. Symphony of the Night.
That's just Castlevania.
It's literally just Castlevania.
It's Castlevania Symphony of the Night and everything after that. And Zelda 2 and Rygar, you can sit there and charge up your experience.
So you're
experience.
Telling me Zelda 2 is more of a Metroidvania than Metroid?
Than Super Metroid, yeah. Oh. Because it has an action RPG element where you can build up your experience and get more powerful just by killing enemies over and over again.
I don't disagree like in Dragon with you, Warrior.
If Binge were putting this episode series together, it would be about 6 games and we'd be done.
You're right.
Good thing you're not the one putting this together.
It is a damn good thing.
Said, let's move along to the next game. This one's kind of obscure because it never came to the US. But it's a game that has a really huge following in Japan. And in fact, it was the inspiration for the game La Mulana, if you've ever played that.
Yeah, I have.
Like, you know, the first time I saw La Mulana, I was like, oh, is this based on Metroid? I asked the creators, the guys at Nigoro, like, what games were you inspired by? Hoping they would say Metroid. And they were like, well, if you have played the games we looked to, you'd know. And they weren't being like snotty. It was just kind of that
you would.
There's a tendency I've noticed among Japanese developers and even corporations to be very gun shy about referring to other people's creations, either in a positive or negative light. And it's not like a pride thing. It's just like, you know, we don't want to bring these other people into this conversation because, you know, it's
a cultural thing.
Yeah. Like almost like a respect for privacy or, you know, like let's not bring them into the discussion because, you know, they didn't ask for it.
Yeah.
So they weren't being cagey or anything, mm-hmm. but it was not helpful to me because I was like, well, I clearly haven't played those games. So
can you please tell me?
So what is it? But it turns out it was this game. It was Nightmare 2, Maze of Gallius.
I have this on the Famicom.
Yes, I have the Famicom version as well.
I almost brought the cartridge just so I could hold it up.
It's good that you didn't because I have two copies of it somehow.
You got to give one to him so all three of us have it.
I will have it on the Famicom that I do not own. Yeah,
with our powers combined.
That's fine. I own two copies and haven't played it yet. So.
Okay.
Nightmare.
I don't know where the second copy came from, but yes, I have two copies of Nightmare 2.
It was a lot by
Maze of Gallius, I guess.
Yeah.
So I've never played the original Nightmare, but my understanding is that Nightmare was basically like King's Knight. If you've ever played that, the Squaresoft top-down fantasy.
I have that on the Famicom as well. Yeah. It's a green cartridge or something.
I don't know.
I think I have it, yeah. King's Knight.
But yes, it was like a top-down shooter. This game is not a top-down shooter. This game is a side-scrolling platformer. Well, no, it's a side-view platformer. Yeah. But again, it's the flip-screen thing.
Screen by mm-hmm. screen.
So it kind of, I mean, and that makes sense because this game started on MSX. The original version was MSX, which did not have free scrolling. So that it makes sense that they went with the flip screen style. But it is a game set in a huge castle. And within the castle, there are multiple portals to sort of like subworlds. And it's all very sort of open-ended and it's all very obscure and esoteric because... there are treasures and secrets and powers and weapons and all sorts of things hidden within the castle, but some of them are very obscure. Some of them are very difficult to find. And so it's one of those games that was really sort of keyed around the idea of that schoolyard sharing of information. Like this game, I feel, was very heavily inspired by Falcom's creations, games like Legacy of the Wizard and Xanadu.
This sounds kind of like Deadly Towers. And I'm not joking.
A little bit.
There's some obscure, weird stuff that you wouldn't even know was there unless you had a guide.
It's something. Definitely that same mentality, vein that same of, school of game design. Mm-hmm. And I think these games were created around the same time.
Yeah.
Deadly Towers was 87 also.
Yeah.
So yeah, like they were all, I think...
Stop.
I feel like they were all sort of inspired by Falcom's games, Sorcerian, Xanadu, Dragon Slayer, that sort of thing. Like lots of secrets, lots of obscurity, some RPG facing elements, but an action genre style.
And aren't there some of those Namco, like Dragon Buster or Dragon something that are kind of like
Dragon,
this?
Dragon Buster is a little more direct action. It doesn't have like the hidden stuff in
and there's
it so much.
There's an overhead kind of
Tower
maze.
Of Draga.
Yeah, Tower of Druaga, yeah.
And its sequel, yes.
Yeah, that feels like... I feel like all of those games were in a period where they were experimenting with this idea, but they didn't just get it. None of them really congeal to me into, like, the thing that you want to play. I don't know what it is. They're all missing some little element of... Probably it's just some sort of punishing difficulty or having to reset after you... die or something like that, instead of just letting you go on and build up your character and be strong.
Yeah, that mindset didn't come into games until Dragon Quest, where if you die, you lose half your gold, but you keep your experience. So
and
if
Dragon
keep,
Quest is the same
if
thing.
If you keep throwing yourself at the bad guys long enough, eventually you'll become powerful enough that you can overcome
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. That's the grinding element where Dragon Quest I could play as a kid as Dragon
Warrior.
That's an
RPG, though. It's not a Metroidvania.
Yeah, but this is what Metroidvania introduced. This Castlevania Symphony of the Night took an action platformer, put in RPG elements like the grinding of Dragon Warrior, where you can just go out and fight random encounters until you get strong enough. You know, if you're not skilled enough to do it by yourself, you can get strong enough to face more difficult enemies easier. Hmm. Anyway, we talked about that before.
That is a
Chris,
RPG
you're just
element.
Looking, you're looking at us weird. What?
I'm just listening.
Okay, good.
I'm anticipating. Okay. I have something to talk about. Don't you worry.
Okay.
Okay. Good. What are you going to talk about?
I'm going to talk about Super Metroid.
Oh, well, that's still years away.
We're not there yet.
We're a long way away from that one.
It's going to be 3 hours in.
I know. Well, you know, I'm actually surprised. A lot of the games on this non-NES 8-bit Metroidvania, it's all Master System stuff. Nightmare 2 was not. But the next game, Golvellius, Valley of Doom, is. And this is an interesting one because it's, I guess, closest in design to Rygar.
Is Gallius related to Golvellius?
Yeah. It's not.
Okay.
I love Rygar. Not.
Gallius was by Konami and Golvellius was by Compile. So
they both mean the same thing in Japanese.
Yes, they both mean
some kind of pasta.
You're going to die a lot.
Okay.
You die.
There you go.
Golvellius was a game, another one that my friend who owned a Master System owned, and another one that fascinated me, and I did better at this one, because it's like a combination of Zelda and Zelda 2, although the side-scrolling portions are more like Dragon Buster as opposed to Zelda 2, because they're all just like forward-scrolling. There's no backtracking. There's no exploration. You go into a cavern or a dungeon, and you just march left or right and kill stuff along your way, and then there's a giant snake at the end, and you kill it. But then you go out into the overworld.
Oh,
and,
yeah. It's the one with the giant snake.
Yes, the giant snakes. Yeah, and then you go into the overworld, and it's like top-down combat like Zelda.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I need to play this again. I think I played it on an emulator, but I don't have the cartridge. So. It looks fascinating.
Jeremy, please tell me about these Bible holes.
I put Bible the Bible holes. Hole reference
in. Oh, did you put the Bible holes in there? Yeah,
what the hell is that?
There was a funny video I watched.
Oh, it's, yeah.
It's some sort of nonsensical thing where you run around... this is the quote from the YouTube video. I don't know who said it, but you dig yourself into these holes here. There's old women that live in them, and for some reason they sell you Bibles that increase your gold. And I was thinking, yeah, that sums it up just about right.
Yeah, Bible hole sounds like something that's going to lead to some sort of scandal, evangelical scandal somewhere down the road.
Bible, that's where we put all the Bibles. No, there is some sort of lack of intellectual storytelling rigor going on here. That was common in a lot of those games for the Master System and other things. They're not necessarily self-consistent, or if they're self-consistent, it's nonsensical. Just like falling in a hole and getting Bibles that give you gold, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. I think that's just one of those.
Not every game could have pay me for the door repair charge. Golvellius actually reminds me a lot of another game that we didn't talk about in the NES episode, but also by Compile, The Guardian Legend. I don't know if you guys ever played that.
We talked about it one time.
Did we? Okay. Yeah. It was like The Legend of Zelda meets a top-down shooter. So you'd explore the top-down maze, similar to in Golvellius, and then instead of doing side-scrolling, platforming, you would just go into a top-down combat view, and you'd like shoot up things and try to fly around and blow up bad guys.
Yeah, maybe we didn't talk about that. Maybe we talked about it. I was thinking about the Battle of Olympus or something.
But that's a different game.
Yeah, it is. Altogether. I like the Guardian Legend.
It was really good.
Yeah.
But Golvellius feels like sort of the rough draft for it in a lot of ways, except more fantasy Zelda facing as opposed to sci-fi. So, you know, we talked about the action RPG and how it sort of supplanted the Metroidvania in the 16-bit era. I think, you know, you saw that with Zelda, kind of going in sort of one direction to the other. Mm-hmm. Zelda 1 was the top-down action RPG. Zelda 2 was a mostly side-scrolling platformer action game with RPG elements. Then Zelda 3, A Link to the Past, went back to the top-down view. The same thing happened with the game that I think in Japan was kind of like the main competitor to Zelda, which was Ys.
Wise?
No. The top-down...
Yes.
Yes.
The first two games were top-down RPGs, much simpler than Zelda in a lot of ways, although they did have real RPG elements, but they also had like really brain-dead combat where you just like run into bad guys and impale them with your sword until one of you dies. But Ys 3 did the Zelda 2 thing and became a side-scrolling platformer. And I feel like Ys 3 is more in the Metroidvania style than Zelda 2 was. You don't have the top-down view. There are RPG elements that you love so much.
Yeah, you can get experience by killing any particular bad guy. And
it's a much smaller game.
Yeah,
there's like six areas.
Are terrible. I've played this. I just don't like it. I can't get into it. I don't know what it is. Is it a cultural barrier?
No, I think it's because it started as a PC game, and so it was converted to consoles. I'm sure you played the Super NES version.
Yeah.
It was converted to, I think, PC Engine, to Genesis, to Super NES, by different companies. I think the NES version was developed by Tonkin House. And have you heard of Tonkin House?
Like Tonkin House cookies?
Nope. Yeah, not exactly a big name in game design. So
Gulf Tonkin.
I think part of the frustration comes from that. The game was remade a few years back for Vita. Or was it PSP? PSP or Vita?
Yeah,
the Oath of Fel'Ghana. And that brings it more into line with E7, E8, where it's not quite top-down view, but it's like a three-quarter camera perspective with multiple characters that you juggle between in a very reflex-oriented combat. You know, in our Samus Returns episode, we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about the reflex-based combat, like the counter system. You just have
this feeling in your bones.
It's just a hunch.
Yeah.
You know,
this is like something I'll find intriguing.
Yes, the melee counters in Samus Returns and how that kind of slows down the pace. The East games, the remakes, the modern remakes, use something similar without slowing down the pace. Like enemies attack more frequently, and when you dodge an enemy attack, it slows down the action, so you get like a bullet time effect. And basically you're rewarded for a successful dodge. Rather than being punished for not dodging, you're just rewarded with an extra like opportunity to attack and to deliver some extra damage. So yeah, they're really good. I would skip East 3 altogether and just play Oath at Fel'Ghana. It's the same story, but done much better.
I feel like I played it and I liked it better, but I cannot get into any of the East things. It's just one of those, it's somehow too Japanese for me to get into. There's sort of like all those Falcom games, the Legacy of the Wizard series.
It is a Falcom game.
It is?
Yeah.
Damn.
You didn't know that? Yeah.
No, I didn't. Okay.
That's why.
So Legacy of the Wizard is great, but I couldn't, you know, I've played some of those other games that were, you know, on emulators for the MSX or the PC 98 or something. And I don't know. I just can't get it. And the E's, all these Y's games, I just can't get into the Y's because it's my least favorite letter.
So I didn't like East either.
I'm sorry, I do have to ask a follow-up on this. So it's number 26 out of 26.
No. What? Isn't it? Aren't there only 26 letters in the alphabet?
There are.
Yeah.
So it's 25?
No, but you're saying it's
your least favorite. You're not talking about alphabetical order.
I'm talking about ranking order.
Yeah. No, Z is probably the last. I like them in the order that they come in.
That's somehow even weirder.
A is my favorite.
So to you, Q is better than R.
Yeah.
Like it's a more versatile, practical letter.
Well,
they're in that order for a reason. Everybody wonders where alphabetical order came from. Somebody decided which letters are the best, and they put them at the front.
This is even weirder because
BuzzFeed did not exist in like the Roman times.
Top 10 letters.
It is even weirder to me that you, Jeremy, are immediately like, oh, it's versatility that makes a good letter.
It is. Like, you go watch Wheel of Fortune. Those are the top five letters right there. They give them to you on the final round.
R-S-T-L-N-E, right?
Yes.
Yep.
R.L. Stein.
No, but for you, the top five letters would be A, B, C, D, E, F. The most versatile author.
That was a sidetrack that we really didn't need to get on.
It's not nearly that funny if you're not sitting here with us.
Oh, it's hilarious.
That's good. That's good Patreon subscriber only content. Yeah,
laughing
for 5 minutes. Yeah. That's great.
So I didn't like the East games either until I played East 7, and they really retooled how the series works. Like, even East 6 was kind of...
What console is that? Like PS2?
PSP.
Okay, PSP.
I think it's on Steam now, so you can play it pretty much however you want, but it plays on Vita. But they overhauled how the series works, and they added that reflex-based combat, and it works much better, and the games just feel more fully featured, fully realized at this point. I mean, the first few East games are pretty good, but now there's been like, what's East 7?
Too many.
Oath of Fel'Ghana, the Sea of Salcetta, and then East 8. So that's like four games in the past decade. So, more Master System. Wonder Boy 3, The Dragon's Trap.
This is a good one.
Yes. Have you played the original version? I know you've played the remake.
I have the cartridge version.
You didn't bring the cartridge with you,
no,
did you?
No, I almost brought it so I could hold it up and show it to you.
I'm really glad you didn't do that with any of these.
Which of the Wonder Boy games was featured on Game Center CX?
Probably the original.
Okay.
I feel like that's the one that's like most punch you in the genitals hard, which is kind of what, you know, Arna goes for.
Okay.
But yeah, this one is not just a straightforward platformer. It's more of an action RPG. Very much in the, I don't know, what is it? What would it be comparable to? I don't really think as of what, 1989, anyone had made a game that was quite like this on NES.
Are you talking about Wonder Boy 3 right now?
Yes.
Okay, not the first one. It's a lot like, I don't know, there's, I mean, Zelda 2, kind of, but it kind doesn't of, have experience doesn't, yeah, points.
Well, it doesn't have the experience points. It doesn't have the top-down area. It's like one continuous space. I guess Castlevania 2, maybe, but it doesn't like it doesn't play like Castlevania 2. Plus, it doesn't have the experience points.
It reminds me of Super Adventure Island 2, which came much later and was probably developed by the same people.
I think that was developed by Hudson. But I mean, Adventure Island and Wonder Boy are all the same thing. So,
watch
that.
I mean, listen to that podcast and you'll find
it's a big, complicated mess. Mm-hmm. But I would say if you want like a modern analog to Wonder Boy 3, besides looking at the remake that just came out this year, the Shantae games are probably the closest thing to it. They feel like they were really designed in that same style. Like you have sort of this village that sits in the middle of the world, and then you go exploring in either direction, left and right, and you know, kind of branch out increasingly from the main town, but you keep going back to it, even though there's not like an inn there that you sleep in. It's just sort of like kind of your launching point for your future adventures.
Yeah, that's a pretty good comparison, I'd say.
Now, am I correct in my understanding that the 2017 remake didn't add anything to it? It's just a straight remake of the original game?
Well, it added new graphics.
Yeah.
And there is like one little element that it added. But yeah, the game actually got its start because the guy who programmed it really loved Wonder Boy 3. And he designed, like he programmed his own engine for a Wonder Boy 3 remake. Like he tried to recreate the game engine. Mm-hmm. So he created such a faithful engine that Wonder Boy 3 can actually switch over to the original graphics, the remake.
So
amazing. So you can get the 8-bit graphics just seamlessly from the new graphics. And the game is exact, like there's no new locations or anything in the game. It's just, it's the same thing. It can even use the same passwords. Like you can use the Sega Master System passwords. You can take a Master System password, input it into the Switch or PS4 game, make some progress, get a password there, and then take that back to the Master System and have the same progress.
That's exactly what I did.
Did you?
No.
Oh,
but I mean, this is a brilliant remake. That remake is incredible. Like just the fact you can push the right shoulder button and it sort of side swipes to the left and to the right. The original graphics come back, or, you know, it just comes back and forth if you want to toggle between them. And, It's amazing. It's just very, very well done.
You said that it changed one element. What did it change?
He added in like some bonuses. Apparently there was a dummy bit in the password system that was present on Master System but not used. So he added some stuff to the game, like some rewards that you can find if you do like ultimate completion and really search around. Mm-hmm. There's like 5 items you can find. I didn't find any of them myself.
Wow.
But they're in there, and those make use of that dummy bit. So, you can still save it in the password. And when you take it into Master System, it doesn't do anything for you. But then if you take it back into the modern game, you'll still keep that stuff.
Who is this fellow who did this?
Omar Cornut.
He must be a genius.
He just really loves Wonder Boy 3 a lot.
Yeah.
And he created an amazing recreation of it.
See, everyone who creates a recreation of game should be the greatest fan of it of all time, like this, I think.
Well, I think that's dangerous. You know, if you're not careful, you could be too slavish or, you know, feel like it's too precious to change. But he did it right. Like the remake keeps all the original content, the same physics, everything, but it adds new visuals and new animation.
New music.
And Modern refined versions
of it. Yeah.
I think this is probably a good case study for this because it's a game that is obscure enough that doing a complete faithful recreation of it is going to introduce
it's
it
also
to
good enough
to
it's also
audiences like us.
It's obscure here, but it's actually, it was a really big game in Europe and Brazil. So it has a lot of fans outside the US.
I also think it just happened to be good enough to actually do a faithful.
Yeah, that was my next question. Does it hold up like compared to like modern, it's like indie game Metroidvania?
It feels like, I think you could probably just pretend it was a new game and it would pass for one of these indie games that come out, you know.
Yeah, I am. So my feeling is that the new animation really makes a big difference, even though it's based on the same keyframes. The more fluid animation, like it's 60 frames per second of like just beautiful hand-drawn animation.
Yeah.
That sort of adds into the very sort of choppy animation that originally existed. It doesn't physically change the game, but it changes your perception of it and makes it feel more fluid. And I feel like I control things better when I'm in the current graphics mode as opposed to the original. It's a really weird, I don't know, like I can't really explain it. Like you wouldn't think that just having different animation would affect how you play the game. But I feel like I have a better sense of, you know, the game physics, the jump arc, the attack range, things like that than I did on the Master System version. He was really careful to keep, you know, the original attack dynamics, like how far, you know, how many pixels forward your sword attacks or whatever. But it works better. It's really strange, but it's great.
And Nintendo should do something like this for Super Mario Brothers 1. Wouldn't that be amazing if it was exactly the same game, but like fluid animation, 1080p, you know, and you could switch back and forth anytime you wanted? That would be just amazing.
Was Mario Brothers Deluxe, was it the same, like,
it was the
physics
same
and everything?
Yeah, it's not that deluxe, really. It's got red coins.
It also lets you play as Luigi. It has Super Mario Brothers 2 hidden inside of it. It has a save system. It has a world map. It's a pretty big overhaul, but it is the same graphics. I think it would be interesting to see, there's kind of a thing going around right now online where people are like, hey, Shigeru Miyamoto, what about the guy who did all the hand-drawn art for Super Mario Brothers 3 and World? Kotabe was his name.
Oh, yeah.
Would you ever want to make a game that looked just like his hand-drawn art?
Yeah.
And Miyamoto's like, oh, I feel like we should always be moving forward. So they're not going to do that. But I feel like Nintendo is way too married to the original sprite art of Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
Like that's iconic for them. You can play as Sprite Mario from Super Mario Brothers in Mario Odyssey.
Yeah, that's so exciting and cool. I love that reference and reverence of the past. I think that's awesome that they recognize it, but it would also be fun to do something else too.
I agree, but I think they depend too much on that nostalgic marketing to change up the game that way. If anything, we're going to see stuff like, you know, Mario Odyssey having the sprite art as opposed to the original Super Mario Brothers done up in Odyssey style art.
Yeah.
Alas. We didn't really talk that much about the design of Wonder Boy 3, but I do think it's worth mentioning a few of the design elements that are kind of noteworthy or interesting. It's a game that introduces the idea of character transformations, which I hadn't really seen in games before that. But you, like the entire point is that you're Wonder Boy, you start the game, you fight the final boss of the previous game, you know, like Symphony of the Night. And after you defeat the mecha dragon, he curses you and changes you into a lizard man. And the entire point of the game is like, get back to your human form. That's what you're really after. You're not trying to save the world. You just want to be a human again.
Yeah, and that's another Shantae connection too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you turn into different characters, like different creatures. There's a lion, a mouse, a lizard man, a piranha man, and eventually human. And like each character, you have to go back to town. That's one of the reasons you go back to town. You have to go back to town to transform into the different forms as you acquire them and switch back and forth. And there's a lot of environmental puzzles built around which form you're in. Like you have to go to a certain place in order to turn into, say, Piranha Man. But initially, it seems like you have to be maybe Lion Man to get to some place where Piranha Man needs to solve a puzzle. So the question is, how do you get to that place as Piranha Man? So the whole world kind of becomes this navigational puzzle. So it's actually really thoughtfully designed. I think that's one of the reasons it holds up so well, is because there is so much care and attention put into the structure of the world and the way everything interconnects.
I love the mouse, the fact you can go back to where you just were as the mouse, and then suddenly you get into these new areas, it unlocks it and stuff.
Yeah, really, and you kind of see that. I think the first game to rip that off might have been Castlevania 3, where you have the helper characters and you can transform into one of them. And you have Grant Anasty, who can turn into, you turn into Grant Anasty, and then he can climb walls and ceilings and stuff. Another game that did the same thing was Little Samson for NES.
Yeah, that,
like 3 or 4 years later, one of the characters is a mouse who for some reason throws bombs, but he can do the same thing. He can crawl along ceilings and walls. Can mice actually climb ceilings?
Can they actually throw bombs?
Yes, mouse I've seen that. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what the deal is with mice throwing bombs in Japanese games, 8-bit games.
But it might be a reference to an old anime or something, for all we know.
But I guess it says something that I'm more offended by the idea of, like, these mice climb walls and walk along ceilings than I am, like, oh, yeah, they throw bombs.
They can climb pretty well in real life. Okay. I mean, I've seen it happen.
Well, now I'm really worried that I'm going to wake up and look up one night and there's a mouse above me.
You're going to open that little trap door in the ceiling and 1,000 mice going to pour out, like Indiana Jones.
Just bought it like 2 days ago.
Is it good?
What kind of car?
It is a 2017 Kia Soul.
Oh, that's neat.
But it is used. So
good.
Already a 2017.
Yeah.
It's a former rental car, but it only has like 9,300 miles on it.
Nice.
So it's got a backup camera, and I love that backup camera.
That's nice.
Anyway, it's not a Metroidvania.
Back
it's
in a Kia Soul.
Did you see the headline yesterday? It was like Kia recalls 300,000.
I did.
Souls.
It was the day after I bought that car. But it was the those were the 2014 to 2016 models, and mine's a 2017.
I just like the idea of recalling souls.
It's just like
Dracula.
Aria of Sorrow.
All right, moving into the second half or second portion of this episode, we're going to begin with a few letters that I got from cool listeners like you. I'm pointing at the microphone. That's you. You're a microphone. From Ethan Morris, early Metroidvanias. I think the interesting thing that I would like to hear you cover is the question, is there anything the formative era of Metroidvanias offer that the later games haven't iterated on and improved? I'm thinking specifically of the core Metroid and Castlevania brands here. The favorites tend to be Symphony of the Night and Super Metroid, but I'm not convinced that those games are better than their handheld sequels. I feel like these classic games get a lot of credit for their place in history, but future games surpass them in responsive controls, visual fidelity, narrative, variety of challenges, etc. So the big question to tackle is, what can I get from early iterations of the Metroidvania formula, that I can't get better from more recent games built on many years of iteration and experimentation with the form? So guys, I'm going to kick that over to you.
Chris, talk about Symphony of the Night.
Yeah, this is going to come up again on the micro episode, but I like the handheld Castlevanias a lot. Like the Igarashi-directed Castlevanias. I really like Aria of Sorrow, Dawn of Sorrow, Portrait of Ruin, Order of Ecclesia, I think, is actually pretty underrated even. But the thing about Symphony of the Night is that it is at least as good as those games are at their best. Completely divorced from the experience of playing it for the first time and the kind of realization that there's a whole other game in there. Symphony of the Night is pretty unparalleled in terms of just the options that it gives you. I don't think any other game, especially like the immediate follow-ups, the ones where you're actually playing as a Belmont and have a whip, no other game really gives you the versatility of that game just by having one button for the left hand, one button for the right hand, and letting you combine weapons in different ways.
Yeah, the controls are amazing.
Yeah, it's the thing that makes that game so good is that you have so many options for dealing with everything that you encounter. Like, you know, enemies don't have, as a general rule, like particular weak points. So you are allowed to deal with them. You can do the fireball spell. You can, you know, use, you know, a sword in one hand, or jump behind them and use the Heaven Sword, that, you know, to take care of things from a distance. It's a really, it's crammed full of stuff in a way that you've written about recently, Jeremy, with all, like, all the little touches. But as good as the later games are, I think the best they get is on the level of Symphony of the Night. And I do think those games get there. I think Dawn of Sorrow is an extremely good game.
Yeah, they're great.
I would say Aria of Sorrow, in terms of play mechanics and overall castle design, is better than Symphony of the Night. But it doesn't hold up in terms of visuals and music. Because, you know, it's GBA versus PlayStation and, like, peak 2D on PlayStation.
Yeah.
Dawn of Sorrow holds up better, but I don't think that the overall game design is as good. If you could combine the look of Dawn of Sorrows with the gameplay and overall, like, castle design of Aria of Sorrow, that would be a game that would exceed Symphony of the Night. In terms of Metroid, what do you think? Like, is anything better than Super Metroid? I personally think Zero Mission is the best Metroid game.
It is. It's really good. It's up there. It might be on par with Super Metroid.
I think... Yeah, I don't know. I like it better because it... I don't know if I can...
It's hard to... Words. Yeah, all I remember is the feel I got when I played it. I experienced joy, as I mentioned. I'm going to mention in another podcast soon. It's just something that was really fun and delightful to play. And, of course, Super Metroid was such a revelatory experience. We'll talk about that in a minute. I'd like to add on Castlevania Symphony of the Night. I like to play those Game Boy Advance games, the Castlevania games, on the Game Boy Player, something like that, on the TV. And I really, really miss the extra resolution of the PlayStation Symphony of the Night game. Anyway, the graphics.
It was good.
I think they are, like, arguably the best handheld games
ever made.
They're pretty close.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but they're up there for sure.
They're certainly good. Like,
they're no Etrian Odyssey.
I don't know. I've never played that.
Pain.
They're certainly my
I know Ayakyo Alien.
I would put
it's Game Boy.
I love Pokemon, but I would put the Castlevania games up there with those. It's like, just, I can play them over and over and over again, and have.
Yeah. I have too. They're great. That's what we all agree with, and that's why we're here, yeah. I guess.
Too bad that run ended with Mirror of Fate.
Yeah.
That's a rough one.
By the same people who made Samus Returns.
Really?
Yeah, Mercury Steam.
That's why.
They've definitely improved.
They were working with worse source material, too.
Yeah.
That's the only one I didn't complete, Mirror of Fate. It's the last one, right?
Yeah.
I find Mirror of Fate, I think I talked about this last time, I find Mirror of Fate to be very interesting and audacious in its storytelling, and very, very bad in its actual gameplay.
Is that where you switch from a boy to a girl?
No, that's Porter of Ruin.
Okay,
Porter of Ruin.
Mirror of Fate is the 2.5D one that's a spinoff of
Lord of Shadow. Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
It's Castlevania :
I didn't get through Portrait of Ruin, and I
Lord of Shadow: Mirror of Fate.
Yeah. I actually like the HD version of Mirror of Fate a little bit on Steam. I don't know why. I couldn't get into it on the 3DS.
Okay.
There you go.
Really looking forward to Bloodstained.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, me too.
All right. So from Tony Spears, hello Retronauts crew. I am of the opinion that Metroidvania style games are the best fit for a slew of different games from the indie side of things. The Metroidvania style is a lot more flexible than it's given credit for, and because of that, it's easy to see why so many games can kind of fall into the category so easily. If you were going to remake a game as a Metroidvania, which would you pick? I would personally like to see a game like Monster Rancher done in the style.
Super Mario Brothers.
There's already one of those.
Oh, Super Mario World. Scan
there. Oh, gee, that's a really hard question, because it's tough to think of a game that's not already in that genre that would benefit from all those elements, like, you know, leveling up and inventory stuff,
okay,
and character customization.
I have one. I would redo Super Metroid as a Metroidvania, and give it the ability to give you gain experience points and levels every time you kill an enemy to get stronger and stronger and stronger earlier in the game if you wanted to.
We'll talk about it in a minute.
I don't think I want an experience system in my Metroid games.
Yeah, I think that's part of the... Well, I'll get to it, but I think that's part of the appeal of those is that...
You don't.
The thing that I realized about RPGs, like JRPG-style games, that holds true like with everything from Final Fantasy to Pokemon, is that if you're patient, you can't be bad at them. If you are patient enough to sit there and grind through, and this also applies to Symphony of the Night and the Igavania games, you can just get powerful enough to bestride the earth like a mighty colossus, laying waste to everything in your way, which I like.
Yeah.
But I think part of the experience of Metroid as I have played it is that you have to be skilled at using all the tools that it gives you.
I mean, Super Metroid is probably in the top three of my favorite games, so I wouldn't actually change it. I was just kind of joking.
Yeah. So what would I want? Chris, did you answer?
No, it's really hard to think of one.
Okay, as the host, I'm throwing it to you. You have to answer first.
Jeez, I'm just looking around the room now to see.
Altered Beast, Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah,
Altered Beast would be cool.
Actually,
that would be cool.
Metal Gear Solid could be kind of interesting. Like Mark of the Ninja did Metal Gear Solid Stealth as a 2D platformer. So you throw it back to Metal Gear Solid, and you go back to the structure of the original Metal Gear Solid, where it does take place in a single environment. That's totally open. There is backtracking. Like at some point you have to go back from late in the facility to a space pretty early on. That could be actually pretty interesting. Like, and I mean, what else is Konami going to do with Metal Gear? Turn it into a zombie survival game? I mean, seriously.
I've got my answer. And again, I think this is something that I talked about on a previous one. Arkham Asylum has so many Metroidvania elements of exploration and getting new gadgets to unlock new areas that I would really love to see a Batman game that was done like that and also good.
How about a 2D platforming Dragon Warrior spinoff? That's a Metroidvania.
Kind of surprised they haven't done that. There is a top-down action RPG spinoff called Rocket Slime.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so good.
Yeah.
It's so good. That was what made me love Dragon Quest again.
I bought that just to play it on airplane. I bought that just to play it on airplane back in 2008.
And it was
fun.
I think the Way Forward Brave and the Bold game, which is like not a lot of people, I think, play it, but both the Wii and DS versions of that game are like super good.
That's more of a brawler, isn't it? I didn't think it was a Metroidvania.
Yeah, the Wii one for sure, but the DS one has like a lot of really cool platforming elements. And at one point Batman gets turned into a gorilla, which is very fun. And so like that aesthetic and that attitude and like the ability to unlock different things that I think would really work well in the Brave and the Bold style because it's so gadget heavy,
right,
would be really fun.
They did the same thing with their Thor game, didn't they?
Yeah, the Thor game is also really good.
Yeah, and they have an Adventure Time game that is Zelda 2. Like, there has never been a game more Zelda 2. Even Battle of Olympus. No. Adventure Time, Hey Ice King, Why'd You Steal Our Garbage? That is by far the Zelda 2-est game that ever Zelda 2'd.
You've got a rude Zelda 2'd.
Pretty much. So, from Kevin Bunch, I find early Metroid-style games to be either incredibly frustrating to revisit or fun but flawed, but at the least they all seem to have at least some good ideas gleaming in the darkness. On the genuinely cool side of the scale, Sega's Zillion on the Master System married Metroid's exploration with impossible missions, room pseudo-puzzles, and ended up a stronger game than either of those.
Wow,
brave, bold words. Brave and bold.
Yeah.
I only wish it weren't so annoying to jump over those damn mines, or that the game included some sort of save or password system. And then there's, Wow. Zelda, Wand of Gamelon on the CDI. It's nonlinear and built around solving basic puzzles and revisiting areas as you find new items to progress. Once you power up Zelda a little, it even gets kind of fun. Actually, getting to that point, however, can be incredibly frustrating given how shoddy the hit detection is in CDI games. Though in some measure of questionable mercy, the game lacks a failure state. It's the little things you hold on to when CDI games are in rotation. Well, that was the most iconic... Yeah. Iconoclastic letter that I ever iconoclasted.
This guy has interesting taste. And I would have to say that I think having interesting taste is much more interesting than going along with the crowd. In terms
by definition.
Of your, yeah. So I had that Wand of Gamelon game before I hate sold my CDI collection back in 2001 on eBay because it was so depressing to even try to play any of those games.
You kept Hotel Mario though, right?
No, I wish. Well, actually, I didn't have that one. I had two Zelda games and like a giant stack of other games. None of them were even remotely playable. And some of them were about, you know, encyclopedias and stuff. But I don't even remember what I'm getting onto here.
What are you getting onto? That you think that was an interesting letter?
Yeah. I mean, okay. He's got cool taste. I mean, the thing is Zillion, you know, by popular consensus, is not better than Metroid, but he thinks it is, and that's just fine.
He does. I don't agree, and that's okay, but it's an interesting opinion.
It is what it is, you know? I mean,
yeah.
Maybe he grew up with a Sega Master System, only played Metroid later, and he's like, Metroid is a huge Zillion ripoff, you know? Maybe he
thought that could very well be. Anyway, so, whoops. I closed my notes. Why would I do that?
You don't need notes for this, Jeremy.
No. Anyway.
We don't need notes.
Let's just jump to Super Metroid. Chris, it's your turn to talk.
All right. So last time I was on here, I mentioned that I had never played Super Metroid. And I think both of you were scandalized by that fact.
Yeah. You can even hear the scandal.
We slapped you, I think.
The camera noises.
But last week, I was in Target. And every time I've been in Target, I take a walk to the electronics section.
You found a copy of Super Metroid there?
Sort of, yeah.
Oh.
They had four SNES classics in stock. So
and you bought all four to scalp.
I bought two. I bought one for me and one for my other podcasting partner, Matt Wilson. But yeah, I was there in the middle of the afternoon. In the words of Bruno Mars, gotta blame it on Jesus, hashtag blessed. So I have sat down to play Super Metroid for the first time.
Hmm.
And I don't know if you guys know this. That game's really good.
I had heard that, yeah.
I know this.
Yeah, I was surprised because we've talked about this before today, and I don't remember which show it was on, this one or the Micro that's coming out next week. But we've talked about the idea of revisiting things after experiencing the games or other pieces of media they've influenced. And I honestly wasn't sure if I would like Super Metroid when I was coming to it after playing Fusion, after playing Zero Mission, after playing Axiom Verge, which I forgot there was not a virtual console on the Switch. And when I searched for Metroid on the Switch, Axiom Verge is what comes up. Yeah. So I've played all these games, you know, not to mention things that I would consider to be more on the Castlevania side of things, like Guacamelee. And
Guacamelee you consider more on the Castlevania side?
I do, actually.
I feel like that is such a Metroid game. I mean, it's melee combat, but like the whole, like the colored power-up, or the colored gating system, like green doors, red doors, yellow doors.
Missile doors.
It's all
I just feel like Metroid. It has more of the like action-y feel. It puts it closer to Castlevania.
Luchadors, you missed that
one. Oh, boy.
But yeah, like I wasn't sure if I would hold up or if I would just be playing it thinking like, oh, this would be better if. But it really is a very good video game. I played it for like a couple hours yesterday, and then this morning before I came over here to record, I just sat down and played it for like 3 hours. I had to stop playing it to drive over here, and not because I was preparing for the podcast, but I was just genuinely enjoying it so much. There's really good like visual storytelling in that game. I like the power-up system a lot. I like that you are able to turn power-ups on and off, which is another thing that you see in Symphony of the Night. If for some reason you don't want to see the names of enemies, Or in the case of Super Metroid, if you need to make a jump that you're jumping too high to actually get. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And holds up in a way that I was not expecting for a game that came out 23 years ago.
I mean, I don't know that anyone has substantially improved on the design of Super Metroid in terms of the style of game. I mean, there are games that do some things better, but I don't think anyone has created a game that in just like every category is absolutely better at doing this kind of game than Super Metroid. Binge, what do you think?
I think Super Metroid is one of the two greatest video games of all time.
What's the other one? Tetris?
Symphony of the Night.
Oh.
So,
really?
I mean, Tetris is, yeah, sure. Okay, it's up there too. But
no, I would tend to agree with you.
I think Super Metroid is one of my favorite games. Yeah, it still holds up very well. It had such a sense of depth and mystery and exploration and music and graphics and gameplay and controls and just everything about it was incredible. There were all these iconic moments. Like the first time you realize, this might be a spoiler for you, should I say it? You go in this, there's a tube, you're going through, you know, and it's water. There's water around it. And you're normally just going through the tube, and then finally you realize you can blow up the tube and go in the water. And that's like, holy crap.
I just got the super bombs. So
yeah, super bombs.
I'm pretty excited.
That is awesome. And then there's another part with these little robots that walk around that you can kind of push around, and they're sort of lonely in a spaceship, like the crash spaceship area something. Yeah. That was just incredible.
Well, and then if you look at the, like, once you bring power back to the crashed ship, the video monitors in the background turn on, and if you look, you like see Metroid images. So you're like, what? How did this ship crash? Did this ship, were they like carrying Metroids and they crashed and that's how the Metroids got on this planet? Is that what was happening? Or were like they attacked by Metroids? Yeah. And the game never explains it, so it just becomes this
mystery. Yeah.
It is an ineluctable mystery.
Ineluctable.
I think one of my favorite things that's happened to me so far, and I don't think I can stress enough how much of an experience it is playing on the SNES Classic, because, you know, like, I'm not completely uncultured. I have attempted to play like Super Metroid before, but something about playing it on an emulator versus playing it like on a television with a Super NES controller in your hand,
it
completes the experience in a way that I wasn't really expecting. Whether it's just like,
I mean, technically the Super NES Classic is an emulator, but it doesn't. Yeah, it's not the like a computer emulator where you're kind of like, oh, it just crashed on me.
Well, it's also a nostalgia machine. Because, I mean, you have one, Jeremy. Bench, do you have one?
No.
Well, the cord is so short that I have to sit on the floor in front of my television. And it genuinely has the feeling
of... You know, the original cord was a lot longer. It's like probably 6 feet or more. Not as short as that one.
Yeah, it's... I
but the controller is essential. I mean, as your main interface to the console, it's how you relate to it physically.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the original controller, if you don't have the original responsiveness of the controller and the original layout, it's just not the same.
Yeah, it's not like playing with a Gravis gamepad.
Yeah, like, you know, I have like a Logitech that basically looks like a PS2 controller that's more than adequate for most things. Like I've played, you know, I've popped on like some of the Game Boy Advance Castlevania's and it's fine, but like something about that experience just completes it. And I encountered the big statue room with Kraid and Ridley and I don't know the other one,
Fantoon and Dragon.
There you go. And then you're in you get to that point where there's the hallway where it's basically doing the Bowser fireballs. From who's the green one?
Oh, Kraid, yeah.
Kraid, yeah. And then you fight, like, a little Kraid.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that's it?
Yeah. Who's just a little bit just slightly tougher than the average bad guy for you're like, oh, did I break the sequence? Am I, like, a place I'm not supposed to be? Or that I was supposed to be an hour ago? And then you go into the next room and you get the real version of the boss. That's an amazing moment that I have not seen that particular trick done that well. Like, I don't know anywhere else. Like, the same thing with the Chozo statue boss that happens very early on.
Oh, man, that is
amazing. A lot of this game plays off your expectations of the original Metroid. The Chozo boss is one because that statue, like, it's the second statue. No, it is the first Chozo statue you come across. And after Metroid and Metroid 2, you're conditioned to be like, oh, this statue is my friend. It will give me a power. And then it stands up and is like, I'm going to kill you.
Its ribs open up and start flashing.
Yeah. It's
that was a good
one. And the Kraid thing also is a callback to the original Metroid 1. In the original Metroid, Kraid is like shorter than Samus. He's like this little fat lizard who throws spikes. Mm-hmm. But two, there is a fake Kraid in the original Metroid if you go the wrong way. Like there's just a Kraid hanging out and you can kill him in like three shots. But he's just like a random copy of Kraid. And if you defeat him, you're like, oh, I killed Kraid. Cool. And you go back to the statue up at the top of the game and no, that statue's not flashing. You haven't actually killed him yet. No. So this kind of does the same fake out, but in a more direct way. And you're still not expecting like little short fat lizard guy to become, you know, two screen tall dude whose attack spikes are actually platforms that you can jump on because that's how big he is.
Yeah. I think it is fantastic to have that on the same like little, I guess it's a console technically, like to have it on the same console as like Super Castlevania 4, which is bad. I don't like Super Castlevania 4.
I guess this Death Glare doesn't come across in podcast.
Fighting words.
I think it's not.
It's a different take on Castlevania.
I like it.
And a good take. Good.
Yeah, I think it's good.
But distinct.
It could be better. I could say that about any game.
Not something that could be better.
It could.
But I think it's interesting to see.
It could be HD.
The aesthetic of what you get in Super Castlevania 4 and the way that environment coheres, but gets weird. Like the rotating rooms. Contrasted like immediately, you know, like right next to Super Metroid and see how direct an influence it was on Symphony of the Night, where like, I don't think it's as good as Symphony of the Night in that Symphony of the Night has so much more, like so much more stuff in terms of inventory and, you know, weird little one-shot power things and, the librarian, but also like, those little moments, like so many more of those little moments of that fountain's turning to blood. There's a peeping eye outside the main thing. Like there's items that don't look like they do anything, but it makes your sprite one pixel taller. Like all the little pieces.
Details.
Yeah. Like, but I think there's
only so much you could do with a Super NES cartridge versus a PlayStation CD-ROM. And Super Metroid does have a lot of that stuff, like the dead guy outside of Kraid's lair.
Who has the...
Like, with bugs all
bugs
over
on
yeah,
him.
Yeah, the bugs fly off.
It's terrible.
That's what I'm talking about, the moments. It tells a story without any words, and you're sort of writing your own story as you play it, as you encounter these scenes.
But the thing is, it's incredible. I think Symphony of the Night has more of those moments, but I don't think you get those if they don't happen in Super Metroid first. Like going back and seeing that and knowing that it's 3 years before Symphony of the Night, the influence is so profound in a way that I didn't really, I knew it, but I didn't know it until I played through. Like just the sheer amount of like visual storytelling and ideas that you get in both of those games that you don't get in Super Castlevania 4.
I'd say visual storytelling is important because you're not reading the names of items and things and, you know, whatever.
And there's
Listen, one of the coolest parts of Super Metroid is when you come back to the original Metroid area. You come through it and you go through the place where you killed Mother Brain. You revisit all that stuff where you get the first
Morph
Ball.
The beginning of the game, you have been there.
Yeah.
Oh, have been?
That's where you start. Awesome. Oh. It's just
you start
like
by
Metroid.
Retracing your escape, yeah.
That blew my mind when I first played that game.
I was like, oh, this is where Mother Brain's case was.
Yeah.
And then later you find out you can bomb through it and like find a secret item in there.
Yeah, that's awesome. Don't spoil it for him.
Telling him.
And there's a place where there's these creatures who run really fast and there's babies or something. And you have to sort of teach them how to jump
up. They teach you.
Oh, yeah. They teach you how to do the jump and the flying.
And
whatever.
It's totally optional.
Yeah, but
it's cool. You don't have to go down there.
There's a super dash jump
where you can like rocket yourself in a direct line and
straight up
and get out of pits if you fall in.
Yeah.
And there's also a wall jump where you can like press against the wall and jump up shafts and stuff. And you have that ability from the beginning. You just don't realize
really?
It. Yeah. The game never tells you, but if you fall into a pit, the only way out is to do the wall jump. And there's these guys who are like,
they're like goat things.
They show you.
Yeah. Yeah. The game doesn't tell you a lot of stuff in a way that I find.
There's no dialogue after the introduction.
Yeah.
Everything else that happens is
in captivity.
Yes. Thank you, Dan.
Is at peace.
Once you get past that introduction, there's no text in the game aside from like, here's what this item does.
Yeah. There's a point even in there where you don't know that you can hold a button down to run faster because it's never told you. And that button is otherwise like,
why?
Right. But once you get the dash, the speed booster, yeah. Then it's like, oh, by the way,
you have to know about it beforehand because there's another area you have to get across before you get the speed boost.
Is there?
Yeah. Or at least there was for me.
You got to the speed boost already?
Yeah. I got the Varia. I just got the super bombs, so I'm very excited. I cannot wait to go play more of it.
Super bomb some more things.
Yeah. And that's, per the question that we were just asked, like, I think that's the value of going back to a game that is profoundly influential, because if it's good enough, and I think the number of games that are substantially good enough to hold up as like an incredible experience. But like if that game was new, I would not be surprised. Like that's how good it is. And I think, you can count those games on two hands.
Probably. I did a slideshow about this. I call them perfect video games.
Yeah.
Super Mario Brothers, Ms. Pac-Man, Doom, Super Metroid. I actually put Earthbound on there, but I don't know.
Pretty excited about playing Earthbound too.
But it's a great game. I mean, those kind of things that are always going to be good no matter what, just the way they were exactly presented to begin with.
Yeah.
And Tetris, Game Boy Tetris, probably pretty good forever.
Yeah, I am glad to be in the I have played Super Metroid club now.
Congratulations. High five. Thank you.
It's worth noting that Matt Wilson told me, we were talking about it. He was like, oh, that's my favorite video game. And I was like really, I was kind of surprised about that because again, I hadn't played it. And I know there's so much that you would think would have iterated on it and improved on it in the last 2.5 decades. And he was like, no, that game is like perfectly designed. And he's right.
The peak of Metroid. So, except for Zero Mission, we were talking about a little bit. Might be.
I'm really wanting to revisit Zero Mission now. Because it's been, I know I played all the way through Fusion. I can't remember if I got Zero Mission. Is that on Advance?
Yes,
it is. Yeah, Game Boy Advance.
Super Metroid is just—it's a masterpiece in game design. So it's hard to top that. I mean, it's just really hard.
We haven't really talked about what makes the design of it, like in terms of structure, so good though, and that is a big part of it. Like, yeah, the atmosphere is great, the little surprises, but the way the power up sequence perfectly meshes with the world design and opens up new boundaries for you as you become more powerful. Like that's really, to me, other games did that, but to me, that is the heart of Metroidvania is as your character becomes empowered, you don't just become stronger in combat. You also become capable of going new places, of seeing new things. And this is the game that does that, I would say, better than any other. Like every weapon you get, it allows you to find, like to access new areas, to reach new places, whether it's obviously the high jump boots do. But then you have, the super bombs that don't just open up the yellow doors, but they also will clear out areas that you didn't know you could clear out before. And they will reveal other hidden secrets.
It is weird to say this because, it's created, but you get the weapons at the perfect times. Mm-hmm. Like they don't give you anything even a little bit too early or late, at least up through the super bombs, because I don't know what comes after, if anything. But it's built for me anyway, in my experience of like literally playing it for the first time today. You always feel like you might have gotten into the wrong area. You always feel like you're just not ready enough. And for a game to maintain that feeling for hours at a time, even as you're getting improved weapons at what I was kind of surprised is a pretty rapid rate. Mm. I'm not sure how long the game is. Like
if you
play it start to finish, but yeah, like I have maybe a total of like 4 or 5 hours into it. And I feel like I'm progressing and getting power-ups at a very quick rate, but I'm still always feeling like I might not be prepared for the next thing to come around the corner.
One really great trick that it uses is that when you enter a new area, you kind of commit to it. And most of the time, you can't backtrack until you get the power-up you need. Like, I'm thinking specifically of when you drop into a big chunk of, like, lower Brinstar, and you kind of drop down a shaft, and you get to a place, and you're like, I don't know if I can go here yet. But you have to, because if you go back and try to get out the route you came in, it's a tall shaft, and there's just, like, those little dudes floating back and forth, and you need the ice beam to freeze them, but you don't have it yet. So you're like, well, I don't have any choice. Like, this is a dead end. I have to go forward.
Yeah.
So it forces you to figure out, like, what is the next step I have to take?
And for me, you have the thought of, like, oh, well, okay, I got the high jump. Is that it? Like, can I jump on top of these guys? And then it's like, no. It's like, well, I need the Varia to get any further into this. Like, it's...
Well, didn't they do the freeze to the guys and go up the corridor in Metroid, the original Metroid?
Yeah, they did. Okay. But here it's used more intelligently. Okay. It's not just used, down and it's not just used to access new areas, but that's also used to sort of serve as a barrier to keep you from backtracking and going out of a place where you need to be. Because that is a risk in these sort of open world games, is that if you get someplace and think, oh, this isn't the right place, even though it is, and you go back, then you've got this entire world that you can roam around being lost. Mm-hmm. So Super Metroid is really good about giving you that sort of subtle guidance. Like, the creator's hand is always kind of at your back and saying, this is where you go. It's actually a pretty linear game, but it doesn't feel like it because it creates the illusion that it's open. But once you go past certain points, it's sort of a point of no return until you get the correct power-up and can backtrack.
That's kind of part of the puzzle of each area, is a new item you get to help you escape it.
Yeah,
it's not, reminds me of Zelda dungeons, where you get a new item every dungeon.
It's not feeling like you're railroaded as much as it's like you have, like, you have this idea of, well, I got to go forward because there's no turning back, which is a different thing from feeling like they're making you go forward.
Right. And then later in the game, when you get to the Meridia, the underwater area, there's actually one part of it that's underwater and one part that is sort of above, and it's more like sandy and rocks. And you have a lot more freedom how you get through that area. And ultimately, you need to get the gravity suit so that you can travel underwater and jump freely like you would when you're above ground or above water. But it doesn't really give you as much guidance because that at that point, it's like past the halfway mark in the game. So the developers are like, you know what you're doing. You just need to, like, figure it out on your own. So at that point, they kind of take off the training wheels and you're free to go about and make your own mistakes. And you know, like, there's a lot to do in that area. And so you kind of have a sense of, like, this is where I need to be and I can get around, but I don't know exactly where I need to go in here. So it's a different kind of exploration. It's not so much like, what am I doing here? How do I move forward? It's more like, I have so many ways to move forward. Which one do I go with? And then when you get to the sort of like the final area before the end, the lair where Ridley lives, that's pretty much just like a loop. So you go in, you go down, you kill him, you come back up. But, you know, the game feels different in every space. And that's one of the frustrations that I'm going to talk about on the micro episode about Samus Returns, is that it doesn't have that feeling. Like, there's no variety between, like, upper Brinstar, lower Ridley's Lair, Meridia. Like, each of the wrecked ship, like, each of those areas feels really distinct, not just in terms of color palette or visuals, but in terms of, like, how you travel and maneuver and solve the mystery of that space. That's something Super Metroid does incredibly well. Like, everywhere in the game feels distinct. And even though you're doing the same things, like, you're doing them in a different way. And there's, like, even an area where you're traveling around by using the grappling hook over these pits, that just, you know, it's one space where you're really doing that in a sort of focused area. And then, you know, after that, you get the space jump and you don't need to do that again. But they make use of all your tools.
One thing that I think Castlevania has always done, going back to Castlevania 1 and honestly, even in Castlevania 2, is creating a cohesive environment. That's one of the real indications of the thoughtfulness in the first Castlevania, that you are moving through a castle and that you see places that you later encounter. And I feel like Super Metroid, even though it has, like, the long elevator shafts that separate one area from the other, does that really well. in an interesting way, that you're going from, you know, a relatively, you know, sterile like lab environment to, you know, the molten like lava section. And it doesn't feel like that's just, oh, this is the fire level. This is the water level. Like there's indications of a cogent ecosystem in a way that
transitions between them.
Yeah.
Good transitions
in a way that's really like thoughtful. And I am enamored with.
Great. So I think we probably ought to wrap this episode up. There's still other stuff we haven't gotten to, but there'll be another Metroidvania episode or three. So we'll talk about those at a future time. But I think, you know, this is probably a good stopping point. Metroid is kind of on everyone's minds these days because of Samus Returns and because of the Super NES Classic. So it's good to kind of like stumble across it and talk about it some more. But we'll save the rest for a future engagement. Game Boy stuff, Super NES stuff, TurboGrafx stuff, if such a thing exists.
Master System.
We did Master System.
There's a Mega Drive game on
there. Like two or three, yeah, okay. Sega CD. So we'll hit those and maybe Symphony of the Night next time. In the meantime, I think we should wrap this up, unless you guys have some final thought.
Death is but a door. Time is but a window. I'll be back.
Wow, that was weirdly deep.
That's from Ghostbusters 2.
Okay. I got
that
it.
That seemed deep.
Yeah.
It seemed deep. You fooled me once, though.
Yeah.
It's Vigo's final words.
Yeah.
I just hope everyone finds someone coming to Super Metroid for the first time in 2017 to be interesting rather than infuriating.
I think it's interesting.
I think it's probably more valuable than me writing or talking about it yet again. I've certainly said enough about that game, but having a fresh perspective on it is great. So I'm glad you had the opportunity to experience it recently.
Yeah, that's I guess
we should let you go so you can play some more of it.
I'm excited.
Bonus. It's a bonus to see someone stumbling on the joy of Super Metroid for the first time. It's really great.
Yep. Okay, so this has been Chapter 3 of the Metroidvania Chronicles of Retronauts. As usual, I'm Jeremy Parrish, and you're listening to Retronauts, which you can download on iTunes, on the Podcast One Network, on the Podcast One app, or at retronauts.com. I, Jeremy Parrish, can be found at retronauts.com, writing on Twitter as GameSpite, on YouTube, look for Retronauts Video Chronicles. And, of course, Retronauts is supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. It's how we pay our bills. The ads you hear, they give us a little bit of money for our bills, but it's really supportive listeners like you who keep us going. And there are cool rewards and bonuses for those of you who subscribe. So I would recommend it. $3 a month, get you cool stuff. More than that a month, get you even cooler stuff. But I'm not going to push my luck here. Mm-hmm. So, Benj.
I'm Benj Edwards. You can find out anything you want to know about me at patreon.com/BenjEdwards.
Like your bank account number?
Yeah, social security and mother's maiden name.
Perfect. Great.
Also, I have an announcement. I'm starting a new podcast.
Oh, yeah?
Called Retronautical. Mm. That's about vintage boats. It's actually called The Culture of Tech. Our first guest is going to be Steve Wozniak. Next, Chris.
You can find me at the
Is that a joke or not? I can't tell.
Which one? The first one or the second one?
It's not actually going to be called Retronauticals, right?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, good luck with your new podcast that isn't infringing on our trademark.
Yeah.
You can find me at the-isb.com with links to all of the comic books that I write, the columns that I write online. You can also find me on Twitter and Tumblr as theisb, T-H-E-I-S-B. And at your local comic book store with books like Sword Quest, Ash vs. Army of Darkness, Deadpool, Bad Blood, Guardians of the Galaxy, Annual.
Man, you're versatile.
Yeah, I am, and I should be hired to write more things.
I agree.
If I were a comic book publisher, I would absolutely hire you.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you.
I'm not, though.
So if this is the third chapter of the Metroidvania series, is this the Marble Gallery or the Chapel?
I think this is the Outer Wall.
Okay.
I don't know.
Mist may pass.
Yes, Mist may pass.
If we get the Jewel of Open, maybe we can make it to the PlayStation next time.
Actually, this is a very small enclosed space, so please don't pass any mist.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, thanks, guys, for coming in. We'll reconvene before too long to talk about more of these games. In the meantime, Chris, enjoy some Super Metroid.
Yep.
And I'm going to go finish Samus Returns. I got to do that. Join us again either this Friday or next Friday. Maybe it's like in 2 weeks. I don't know. Some Friday soon for a Retronauts or Micro dedicated to Metroid 2 and its remake. We're going to go to the mats with that one. Take it to the cleaners. In the meantime, check us out again next week for another full episode. That'll be awesome, I'm sure of it. Bye.